Hi, I'm Tom Christensen. I'm the director of the China and the World program here at Columbia University. Today we have in our speaker series a special guest because she's one of our own. It is Sabina Mokri, a recent PhD from the University of Leiden, political science department, and an associate researcher at the German Institute of Global and Area Studies in Hamburg. Sabrina's dissertation focused on the role of think tanks in China in forming what political scientists call the national interest, and thereby affecting China's policy. It's a novel approach to China's foreign relations. Before pursuing her PhD, Sabrina worked at the Mercator Institute for China Studies, which is not only Germany's leading China research institution, but it is Europe's largest China research institution, is my understanding, and has been famous for being sanctioned by the Chinese government in recent years. She's published work in the Journal of Contemporary China, Foreign Policy Analysis, the Pacific Review, and International Politics. We're thrilled that she's here. She's teaching a class here at Columbia, and we're thrilled to have her. And she's going to make her presentation on the topic of her thesis. And please welcome Sabrina.
Yeah, thank you. As you might notice, I adjusted a title slide.
Wait, I said Sabrina. I am so terrible. My notes. Her name is Sabina, and I got it wrong every single time, and I'm terribly embarrassed. And not only did I get her name wrong, Sabina, it's Sabina, I know it's Sabina, and I got her name wrong, but her family is here, so it's even more, and welcome to her family, her father, Peter, and her wife, Charlotte, and I apologize.
Yeah, so
that was bad. That's unprecedented.
China shifting national interest, the underrated role of think tanks and scholars. So I will first start out by showing you the ways in which the official construction of China's national interest has changed under Xi Jinping. Then we'll go through a few common explanations and why I think they don't work. And then we will zoom in on the influence of scholars and think tanks. And then I will close out with implications and some future work that I see. So researchers actually spend quite a lot of effort to figure out what China's national interest or China's national interest is. And some acknowledge that national interest can change. And some also, there's quite a bit of a debate that under Xi Jinping, there were a lot of changes. But actually, nobody has systematically traced yet how China's national interest has changed under Xi Jinping. And I understand China's national interest as constructed, and this allows us to trace changes over time. So I developed my own conceptualization of what a construction of China's national interest is. And I did that by drawing on a pretty kind of old conceptualization by Donald Nüchterlein. That's from the late 1970s. And he talked about different basic needs that states have. So I kind of used that as my inspiration, but linked it to recent empirical accounts of what national interests are that I found in the international relations literature. And so thinking all these things, I understand the substantive content of China's national interest to consist of those components. So it is in China's national interest to protect its territory, political system, and citizens from threats. And this also includes a discussion of what kind of threats there are and ways to guarantee China's security. The second component is about economic issues. So it's in China's national interest to expand its external economic relations. That kind of combines domestic economic developments and the world economy. Then lead global governance is the third component of the official construction of China's national interest. This covers both China's disposition to take on a leadership role in global governance, the kind of ideas, action it puts forwards, and also stretches across a whole range of global governance issue areas. then it's also in China's national interest to promote its values abroad. So that kind of covers different requirements to be able to promote its values and also how it how it implements that. Then we've got one component that focuses on the region in which China is situated. So here, it's in China's interest to control the Asia-Pacific, the region around it. And then the last one is offering global public goods. So this covers both the means and ends of offering public goods to the international community. These six components, so I distinguish these six components, and what this what we will see is that there is a variation in how prominently these components feature over time. And when we then examine this, so examining this variation over time allows us to capture changes in the official construction of China's national interest. So I basically did two things, or for me, the shifting national interest consists of two areas. The first one is a shift in the relative salience of these six components, and the other area is shifts in policy substance which within each of these components. So these are more more subtle shifts in policy substance. And what the, how this looks like, I will show you in a bit. This is the data I've been working with. So here I looked at a whole range of different foreign policy statements, starting by the most authoritative document in the Chinese system, of course, Political Work Report to Party Congress every 5 years. And then the CCP, CCP General Secretary's international speeches, also his domestic speeches on foreign policy, government work reports issued every year, the five-year plan, a whole range of policy papers covering different foreign policy issues, and occasionally, other leaders would do an international speech. So, foreign minister, of course, but also sometimes it's the premier that speaks at the UN General Assembly and things like that. And then there's also the foreign minister occasionally also talks to a domestic audience. So, this is the official foreign policy statements I've been working on, and I started. So, my analysis starts when Xi Jinping came to power in 2013. So this is this is the time frame. And first we're gonna look at the shifts in the relative salience of the different components. And I selected the ones that were most interesting, the trends that were most insightful. So first of all, there's been quite some shifts in how much attention the Chinese government attributed to the different components of the official construction of China's national interest. And so I think the most important development is that over time, more and more emphasis has been put on lead global governance. And this has that trend has already started in 2014. And in 2016, it kind of overtook offering global public goods. And since then, it's been consistently the most important or the most prominent component. Compared to controlling the region, there's quite a drop in emphasis, and is after around 2015, and especially after 2018. And this also means that, so here are the difference between how much emphasis there's put on the global level as compared to regional level, that increased also quite a bit. So these are the gray bars that you can see here. So
what are the gray bars again?
The gray bars is how much is the difference between lead global governance and control the region. So I looked at how much difference there are. So this just shows you kind of the gap between them. So these are shifts in kind of another big picture level, shifts in how much prominence the Chinese government puts to certain aspects, certain components of the national interest. I also did a more fine-grained analysis looking at shifts in policy substance that I identified through frame analysis, a technique that I adapted to analyzing Chinese official foreign policy statements. And I found a lot of shifts in policy substance, some more interesting than others. And I don't want to go through all the ones that I found, but I brought a few snapshots, a few highlights. And the first one here is growing deficits in international policy politics. So in Xi Jinping in 2017 at the first Belt and Road Forum talked about that there were deficits in peace development and governance and at the international level. And then in the China and the World White Paper issued in 2019, they talked about a growing deficit in governance, trust, peace, and development. So here it's not no longer just deficits, but the deficits are described as growing.
Yes.
And and here also trust is added. In the same year at the BRICS summit, he focused on given the audience and what this institute, what this organization is about, probably focusing on the world economy, also talking about a greater deficit, and here it's not about peace got dropped, but it's about governance, development, and trust. So these are this is one policy shift, one shift in policy substance that I found interesting. Another one is and that's kind of relates to the first one is Chinese or the Chinese leadership's ambitions for leadership in international politics. So in his famous speech at the 2014 Center for War Conference on Foreign Affairs, Xi Jinping described China as having closer than ever interactions with the international community. In the same year, the foreign minister and also a number of white papers described China as an important member of the international community and as working with the international community. And then in 2016, Wang Yi at the annual symposium that the Ministry for Foreign Affairs does with the their annual symposium, he talked about actively guiding the international community. So this shows that he no longer talked about China being part of the community or working with the international community, but playing a leading role in that. So that's another shift in policy substance that kind of tells you something about the growing ambitions of the Chinese leadership on that. So I found a number of such shifts in policy substance. I also, as I showed you, found quite some shifts in how much attention the Chinese government attributes to different components of the national interest. So I would say that China's national interest really has shifted under Xi Jinping. And the question now is, of course, what can explain that? What are explanations for that? And a lot of common explanations focus on our status explanations that are located at different level, from the individual level up to the international system. So they focus on leaders' belief, ideological factors, bureaucratic actors, and geopolitics. So we'll go through these explanations and show how I would apply them to the shifting national interest. So much research on the transformation of China's foreign policy starts with Xi. They talk about his personal background, personal worldviews, and try to assess look at these factors to explain changes in China's foreign policy under him. And due to the centralization of political power that we've seen, that these explanations should actually play an important role or should work. I applied that to my dependent variable and said that if Xi Jinping alone determined the official construction of China's national interest, then other foreign policy actors' statements and societal actors' contributions to foreign policy debates, which would match his statements. So it would be Xi Jinping says what the national interest is, and all the other actors follow suit. So all actors in government, all societal debates about foreign policy, which follow his line. And here I got some, I analyzed how prominently the different components of China's national interest feature in Xi Jinping's statements and in statements by other foreign policy actors. And there are some differences. So for example, for lead global governance, that's actually a bit more prominent in other foreign policy actor statements than in Xi's statements. For lead economic external economic relations, it's the other way around. So there is a bit of, there are a bit of differences between Xi and all the other foreign policy actors within the Chinese system. Then when we move to societal actors, the differences are even more pronounced. That the colors don't really work that well here, but what we see is that, for example, lead global governance is a lot more prominent in Xi's statements than it is in that it is in a societal actor. So it's kind of half than for. For global public goods, that's a lot more prominent in the societal statements compared to Xi's statements. So the actual numbers are not that important, but what is important is that there is actually quite a bit of difference between Xi's statements and the societal actors and also the foreign policy actors. So it's not just Xi Jinping saying what China's national interest is and all others follow suit. So that explanation doesn't quite get it. And then when we look at, or another common approach is bureaucratic politics approaches, saying that it's different actors within the Chinese system that drive Chinese foreign policy. It would be that a certain actor determines what China's national interest is, and the others follow suit. So here, if bureaucratic actors or one bureaucratic actor would shape the official construction of China's national interest, then how they construct China's national interest would reflect, it would be reflected in the official construction of China's national interest. So it's might be not Xi who says what the national interest is, but the foreign ministry or another actor. So to look whether that was the case, I aggregated the differences between those actors. And so this is just cut through all the different components. And so there's the least difference is, I think that's pretty unsurprising, is between the general secretary and all the other actors. So Xi Jinping has the most impact on the official construction of China's national interest. And there's also quite a gap between the official, between all what all actors put forward, and especially the foreign minister, for example. So it's not one, it's not one bureaucratic actor that kind of determines what China's national interest is. Another common explanation is ideological factors. So here, a lot of researchers look at Marxist concepts in woke folk traditions, or look at Confucianism and say that that's ideology really is what drives Chinese foreign policy. And here, given the renewed emphasis on ideology under Xi, I think many would expect that ideological factors actually play a big role in Chinese in how China constructs its official national interest. And if that was the case, then I would expect promote China's values to be the most prominent component, because this is the one that really, this is the, of the six components, this is the one that goes to, that captures ideological factors. But as you see here, it's actually the component that is least salient, or the second least salient across the time frame. So the other components are all a lot more prominent, and so ideological factors don't play that much of a role. And the last common explanation is explanations that look that start at the international system. So here, the idea is, of course, that the external environment shapes China's foreign policy. So many realist approaches would say that states want to maximize power vis-a-vis other states to guarantee their survival in the international system. So here, if the goal was to maximize China's relative power, I would expect that defend China's territory, citizens, and political system, and expand China's economic relations would be the ones that are the most important in components of the official construction of China's national interest. And if you remember the graph from just right now, that was not the case, but you can also see it here aggregated. So the defend territory, citizens, political system, and expand economic relations together are about a quarter of all the other of the whole official construction of China's national interest. So it doesn't it doesn't dominate.
Which color is
what? So it's yellow. No, sorry, it's green and green and orange. When you look at green and orange together, those are the ones that are of interest right now. But the others are actually a lot more prominent. So what it shows is that the status explanations don't really fail to account for the observed shifts in the official construction of China's national interest. That none of these explanations really was the one that was very convincing. So this made me turn to societal explanations. And there are a lot of societal actors that one could look at. And I chose to focus on think tank analysts and university scholars. So, and there are two main reasons for this focus. And the first one is that when one considers all the literature on societal actors' influence on Chinese foreign policy, those two appear as the ones that are most likely to influence China's foreign policy. So I thought it makes sense to start with those. And the second explanation, or the second reason, was that, as you've seen, my dependent variable, the official construction of China's national interest, is quite abstract. It's not, this is my way of kind of grappling with the fact that like, what is Chinese foreign policy? It's such a huge thing, and to kind of map variation over time, I had to break it down in some way. And I did that through that conceptualization. But this is, of course, all on the ideational, on the rhetorical level. So this is, and think tank analysts and university scholars, their contributions would also provide ideas and abstract concepts on that, as opposed to, I think, that especially business representatives, for example, would make more concrete suggestions on more narrowly defined issues. That this didn't quite, that wouldn't have worked as well. So that's why I look at foreign policy experts, and I distinguish between those groups because there are actually important differences between the two. One big challenge is to not to select on a dependent variable, to not select on the think tanks or scholars that are commonly claimed to be very influential. I'm sure that everybody of you has a list of that. Some think tanks come to mind immediately, and you would say that, or those are the ones that certainly should have some influence. But I did not start out with focusing on individual institutions or individual scholars, but wanted to get more on the kind of structural conditions. So it was important to carefully select the institutions that I look at. And so for the IR scholars, for example, I first identified Chinese IR scholars, leading Chinese IR scholars from all international relations department across China. And then I categorized them all based on how close or distant they are to the state. And what exactly that means, we'll see in a bit. But I did categorize them, and then I selected 10 that are close, 10 that are distant, kind of to have a spread to be like, okay, I would assume that the ones that are close are have most influence, but I also have others. So I have.
How do you judge close and distant?
I'll explain that in a bit.
Okay.
So these are the scholars I selected. We don't have to go through that, but just to show that. Similarly to the think tanks, there are 26 foreign policy think tanks, at least that's what kind of the literature, what I got from the literature. And then I also categorized them and selected 5 of each group. And so then the first step, and these are the institutes that I ended up looking at. The first step then was to assess whether there was a match or how well the official and the societal construction of China's national interest matched. And this is really important because if there was no fit at all, if there was no overlaps at all, then it would be the case that experts didn't influence the official construction of China's national interest. So if there was like, we have the official construction of China's national interests and societal debates are something entirely different, then there would just be no links. On the other hand, if there was a perfect match, if there was a perfect fit so no differences whatsoever between the official debate, the official construction and the societal debates, then I would also assume that it's very likely that the state dominates foreign policy and experts don't have anything to say. And then it would also make no sense to assess their influence. Luckily enough, I found that there were some overlaps, but there was no perfect match. So, and I have that here. So this shows the lines that are through are the official are how prominently the component of the national interest appears in the official documents, and the lines with the dots are how prominent they are in the societal debates. For some, it's for control of the region, it's actually pretty similar. For lead global governance and offer public goods, there are some differences. Sometimes the trends even go into different directions. So, the overall weight is also pretty similar. So, lead global governance is the most important in official statements and in it's actually not. The public, there are some, for some, the weight is not the same, but for most of it, I've just selected a few here. For most, it's the weight is roughly the same. So there are some overlaps, and I also have some overlaps in shifts in policy substance that I won't show you today, but it's enough to see that there's no perfect match, because then those lines would just be the same. But there are some overlap, some similarities. So since there's no perfect match, there is no transmission belt between the societal debates and the official construction of China's national interest. So it's not what this means is that sometimes scholars and think tanks influence the official construction of China's national interest, sometimes they don't. So that's kind of the takeaway from here. And then the question, of course, is when do they exert influence? And this is what I focus on. And there are two intervening domestic structural variables that are important here. And the first one is societal actors' proximity to the state. And the second one is the state's openness to societal input. And those two variables facilitate and constrain societal actors' influence on the official construction of the national interest. I will now go through those or explain the two in more detail. So the first one is societal actors proximity to state. So how close or distant is a societal actor to the state? And this depends on the actor's extent and quality of formal ties and interactions with party state institutions. So there are two areas with different factors. So formal ties to the party state are things like institutional ties, governmental recognition that an actor receives, or the frequency in which they do government-funded research projects, for example. Then interactions with party state institutions are something like the membership, whether they're members in policy advisory committees, whether they do presentations in front of the CCP leadership, or how frequently they attend workshops with policymakers. So I for selecting the societal actors, I actually assessed each of these six factors for every actor and kind of saw how weak or strong each one was appeared. And what is now really important on a conceptual level is that these being close or distant to the state, these are relative terms. So none of the actors I look at are completely independent from the state, but some are closer than others, some are more distant than others. So it's kind of, this is what is important here. And for the time span of my analysis, so it's like roughly, for 10 years, I consider this factor to be fixed. So I would say that, for example, a scholar can, over the span of his career or his life, can become closer or more distant to the state. But in and the same could also happen for a think tank, for example. But for the relatively short time frame that I look at here, I consider them to be the actor's proximity to the state to be fixed. The second variable is the state's openness to societal input. And here I draw on the authoritarian politics literature and the idea that autocrats constantly worry about their political survival. And because of the dictator's dilemma, this opens up inroads for societal input. So they actually, authoritarian leaders actually need to know what the public is thinking to sustain their rule, but they have a hard time accessing that information because people are afraid to speak out out of fear of repression. This is what is behind that. So when the state is open to societal input, it would encourage societal actors to provide input, expertise into policymaking. When they are closed, they would crack down on societal debate. And this is also, this factor is also, so open and close to the state is also in relative terms. So even if the state is open, it's of course still an authoritarian system, and it's within the limits and constraints of this. So it's more open or less open in compared to the other instance. So the two domestic structural variables bring me to, I mean, every political scientist will have expected that's gonna happen now. So this 2x2 and with those four scenarios. And I think the most influence and least influence are the ones that are pretty intuitive. So when societal actors are close to the state and when the state is open to societal input, then we would expect that they have the most influence on the official construction of China's national interest. And if they're distant and the state is closed, then we would expect least influence. And then the two others, the two remaining are actually the ones that are a bit more interesting, I think. And that is, to distinguish them, I think we could, or I argue that under authoritarian rule, the state always takes prominence over society. So this means that the state's openness to societal input allows societal influence on the official construction of China's national interest, whereas the proximity to the state facilitates influence by offering channels through which influence can be exercised. So to say that a bit more less nuanced, we could say that openness to societal input is more important than proximity. So when the state is open, this is kind of more important. So that's the second most influence, as opposed to when the state is closed to societal input, and the it doesn't really help that the societal actor is close. It doesn't balance each other out. So that's the second least influence. Yeah. So that's the theoretical argument, and then I assessed how well that fits to both scholars and think tanks. And to do so, I tried to pin down societal actors' influence by looking at how many and what shifts in policy substance did the actors actually influence. And for pinning down this influence, I posed two questions. And the first one is, could the societal actor actually have influenced the policy shift? And this can only happen if the policy shift first appears in societal debates and then appears in official foreign policy statements. That's kind of the basic necessary condition. So that's the first thing I looked, I assessed. And then the second one is, did the societal actor influence the policy shift? And this is, here I did an in-depth assessment of the policy shifts I found in the societal actors' contributions, and through a close reading and interpretation of the relevant text parts. And it's because sometimes a policy shift, as it appears, would appear in a societal actor's contribution in the academic article or in the policy report, but it's the same as appears in the official statement, but it isn't really important for the societal actor's contribution because it's just in a footnote or it's in reference to another piece of work. So and then I would claim that the societal actor actually didn't influence the policy shift. But after posing those two questions to all the shifts in policy substance that I found in the societal debates, I had a list of policy shifts that were influenced and could see whether these match my theoretical expectations. And we'll have a look at scholars first. So for scholars, all my expectations were fulfilled. All out of the policy shifts that they influenced, the vast majority was by scholars close to the state under the condition that state was open to societal input. And all the others and the least were when distant scholars under closed when the state was closed to societal input. So all my expectations were met. And now the question is, what happened between open and closed for scholars? So when did that happen? What happened there? And here I looked at changes in domestic structures and how they affected scholars. And this argued that the state became less open to societal input after 2016. And a key turning point here was Sidney's speech at the National Conference on Ideological and Political Work in Colleges and Universities in December 2016. And I brought a few quotes from that speech that all show you that that were then by scholars interpreted as an intensification of ideological control. So the most of these things, of course, were in place or happened also before, but with this pretty prominent publicized speech, it also became clear to scholars that kind of the environment shifted. And this was, this speech or afterwards was accompanied by increased retaliation against scholars from 2017 onwards. So many of these cases are documented in the literature, where academics were dismissed or disciplined by their university authorities. limits were introduced on collaborations with foreign scholars or even meeting with foreigners and sort of as more reporting on that. And so this kind of all change the climate or the working environment for scholars. And I argue that this kind of scholar for scholars, this is a signal that the state was less open to their input. And another thing I looked at scholars in other countries as well, scholars are interested in getting more funding for their research or have to be after funding for their research. So there's the National Planning Office for Philosophy and Social Sciences that administers the bulk of research funding that goes into the social sciences and international relations. And I looked at, they provide funding and they have annual funding calls where they list topics on which scholars should do research on. And I had a look at what kind of shifts there were in these topics listed. And the first thing that is interesting is here. So the shift that the topics kind of relate to different disciplines. And here, international relations, international studies, as they call it, actually there were after 2016, there were fewer and fewer topics that kind of related to IR. So, but there were others that were more interest. And then the other thing is that so in the it's the topics on which people should do research on are quite elaborate. So. I looked at how prominently different ideological concepts, as well as Xi Jinping's name, featured in these funding calls, and that especially Xi Jinping's names and official foreign policy slogans all became a lot more important or a lot more prominent after 2016, kind of, and I interpreted this also as signals to the scholars that ideology matters more and that ideological controls got tighter, which then mean, which I then see as less space or that the state is less open to societal or different. Societal
what are the projects. Funding calls and how do you get access to all their applications for funding?
No, these are, they're not applications for fund. They are, they issue every year a call for funding.
Oh, ask then, people to apply?
Yeah, and then they say these are the topics that you could apply for. And people apparently take these very seriously because, it's not, I also have data on what kind of research projects people did, but and how that is, but I think that's not that important here, because here what is important is what this is kind of a key instrument through which the state signals what kind of input it is mm-hmm. interested in. So after 2016 the state was a lot less interested in or signaled that it was less interested in input from scholars, and this then here matches the what is in the below section. So a lot less scholars influence a lot less policy shifts. So this is kind of what a quantitative assessment looks like. I also have a few case studies, examples of what this then really looked like in practice. So one policy shift that scholars influenced was that Chinese government described itself as playing a more proactive role in setting international goals. This is something that appeared in the government work report in 2015 and also in the EU policy paper in 2018. So that's a shift in policy substance. And this was kind of foreshadowed or in this appeared first in academic debates. So for example, Xinjiang from Fudan University in 2014 explained that he kind of indirectly related to this shift or indirectly foreshadowed this shift in policy, arguing that in this case that there's nothing wrong with establishing a code of conduct for the South China Sea, but that the United States should not ask China to comply with any rules. So this kind of hints at a dissatisfaction with international rules and how they are made by the US. So from that, that kind of indirectly relates to that the Chinese government should play a more pronounced role in setting international rules. In 2013, another scholar from Tsinghua University kind of directly foreshadowed the Chinese government's playing a strong role in setting international rules by saying that actively participating in the process of drafting and refining international law and international rules is one of the prerequisites for China's sustainable security strategy. So he called upon the Chinese government to get onto that and to establish more international rules. Another example I'd like to share is that the Chinese government claims to develop its own form of multilateralism. This is kind of foreshadowed in the academic debates by extensive descriptions of how what the U.S. multilateralism looks like, and kind of what the Chinese government could emulate from that, what they could how this could be an example. And another one is that Wang Yiwei in 2020 argued that some countries accused China of so-called selective multilateralism, and this is something that then later appears in official foreign policy statements as well. Another example is increasing competition in international politics. So a couple of scholars developed the notion of great power game, and that's also something that appears first, or that initially appears in the academic debate. So that's what I found for scholars' influence. And then when we move to think tanks, there overall the differences between the four scenarios were not as pronounced as for the scholars, and also not all my expectations were met. So I'm still figuring out why or how that. How that can be. One interpretation would be just that for think tanks, proximity to the state and the state's openness to societal input is just not as important. So that's an important difference between the two groups of actors. And here, what is interesting is that there was also a change in how open the state is to societal input, but it goes into the other direction than for the scholars, because in from 2015 onwards, the Chinese state signals to think tanks that it was a lot more interested in their input. So there was an important policy document issued in January 2015, kind of specified the role of think tanks and clearly laid out what think tanks should do and gave them a more pronounced role. And this policy change was also accompanied by giving think tanks increased funding. So that really is so kind of think tanks in my time frame of the analysis really moved from before it was closed, and then after 2015 it was a lot more open. But overall the differences were not as pronounced. I also have a few case studies on individual policy shifts. So think tankers pushed the Chinese government towards stronger international rulemaking. So Zheng Yuan from the Institute for World Economics and Politics at CAS, for example, argues that in 2013 that China was increasingly under pressure from international rules. And then analyst at Kikir argued that the international system was dominated by Western powers, and that this also had something that also influenced international rules, suggested that the Chinese government should get onto that and make its own rules. I also found a lot of policy shifts that related to the Chinese government rethinking international partnerships. And this rethinking was foreshadowed in think tank debates by a lot of focus on how China's international competitors were doing partnerships. So there were a number of publications that looked into the idea of global partnerships, how the US would structure global partnerships, how the US and China, or the China and Japan would form how their partnership developed. So there was this idea of developing global partnerships came up or was developed a lot in different think tank publications, and then got taken up in the or kind of formed the backdrop for the Chinese government rethinking its approach to international partnerships that I identified in the official foreign policy statements. This is how scholars and think tanks exerted influence and to. Ooh. Night froze. Okay. To close out, I want to talk a little bit about implications and about future work that I see. So I see, first of all, implications for understanding the PRC under Xi. So I think I've shown that ties between the party state and society are multifaceted, and that under certain conditions, societal actors can still influence the official construction of China's national interest, even given the fact that political rule has become a lot more centralized under Xi Jinping. And for re-examining societal actors' influence on foreign policy and on China's role in international politics, I think societal actors' proximity to the state and the state's openness to societal input are two critical variables to assess. And the state's openness to societal input can vary between different groups. So we've seen different patterns for think tanks and for scholars. And it's, I think, for many scholars working on Chinese politics, they would all say that the regime adapts its strategies to consider societal input, but usually those changes are attributed to different leadership generations. And what I've shown here is that it's also on a more on a much shorter level within one administration, and that there were also changes there. And I think there are also a few implications for understanding other authoritarian states. So I think that my insights could be generalizable for to other states with similar scope conditions, and I think also the proximity to the state is something that could be valuable to also analyze other societal debates in other regimes as well, because I think that this factor could also be operationalized for other contexts. In terms of future work, one question I always get asked is, does it matter what kind of issue we are talking about? So is scholars and think tanks influence conditional on the foreign policy issue? And this is something that I'm currently working on. So I try to introduce the substance of the official construction of a national interest as a third additional intervening variable. I don't have any clear answers on that yet, but that is coming. And then the other thing is, as I've said before, I look at foreign policy rhetoric, the official construction of China's national interest, not on foreign policy behavior. So that's a whole different area that one would need to assess whether what I've found would also be applicable to foreign policy behavior. And in terms of the applicability to other authoritarian states, I think what I did would also be applicable to other states, but this, of course, needs to be tested And but I think that would also be interesting to take these insights from the development of Chinese context to other contexts as well. So thank you for your attention. And I'm looking forward to your questions.
Thank you, Sabina. Thanks very much, Sabina. I have some reactions and some questions, and I'll turn it over to the audience. I think you've sort of established that the state is more closed to outside inputs since 2016 under Xi Jinping, which is the kind of standard view that academics and think tankers are kind of frustrated and have less input into the system, less freedom of action. The part that I found more puzzling was the fact that your think tank results seemed the reverse of your expectations, whereas the scholar results were consistent with them. And I wonder if you could say something about why that would be the case, that distant think tanks in a closed system would be as influential as they were, whereas close think tanks in a more open system were not very influential. And I wonder if it might have something to do with the process by which the think tanks exist. In a sense, they're all state think tanks, especially some of the ones you listed. Like I saw CICIR on there, and they're basically like an intelligence agency, right? They don't really have the pretense of being an independent think tank, even though they represent China and all the track twos that I participate in their track twos, but it always feels like the Americans are sending scholars and the Chinese are sending government officials. And then there were other think tanks that might be considered somewhat more distant. But with the scholars, I think it might be hard to tell. And I guess one of my questions about the scholars is whether their proximity to the state explains why they write the articles that are followed by policy changes. In other words, that they're being fed something by saying, you know, here's what we're thinking. This is the direction we're thinking of moving in. You know, why don't you float this out there, see how people react to it before we make the announcement. That would be a kind of a cynical view of why certain scholars seem to be influential when they may just be in the know, right? And then a totally separate set of questions, Sabina, is this is all for the this is all for the Xi Jinping era, right? So this is an era of largely one person rule. And I think people will probably ask you, Sabina, that whether this applies in a collective leadership. And I guess the expectation would be in a collective leadership or a more collective leadership, like under Hu Jintao, that the think tanks and scholars may be more influential by influencing different leaders rather than a united line, that there'd be more policy space for people to make a difference in a collective leadership than under us. But I don't know if you have any views on that and whether your 2x2 would apply in a situation in which there might be five or six top officials who are quite influential in policy or not. So that's a lot. Appreciate your talk, Sabina. And then I'll open it up to the audience afterwards and let you field your own questions.
Should I answer first? Or?
Yeah, whatever you like. Yeah.
Okay. So the results for the think tanks are quite puzzling. And I think what I would do next is to it might be the case that the distant and close is just too rough. And some of them are very, very close. And so it might be that they should not even be considered as societal actors. So I might see how that would change the picture. And I think that what could be going on there. I need to see that a bit more, a bit closer. When I first started working on that, I distinguished between very close and very distant, but that proved a bit difficult to implement at that point. But now it might be a good idea to get back to that. And then, so The second question about scholars being fed information. The biggest challenge is, of course, to say in which direction influence is happening. And what I think is really important to say is that I look at the very small part of that picture, and there is, of course, also, which I think might be the bigger picture of the state influencing scholars. So that's kind of the flip side or the verse of my project. And I don't know how big the difference between those are. One would need to do my project kind of the other way around to assess that. But I think that, or I hope that once I have a more when I describe in more detail how different shifts in policy substance were influenced to kind of eliminate those issues there. Because yeah, that's also when we think back at the different models that scholars between links of Chinese scholars and foreign policy, it's one of the heuristics or one of the models that it's the state telling scholars to try out different ideas and to propagating them. So that's certainly also going on. I try to look at this the instances where scholars influence or think tanks influenced, and then applicability to other administrations. There is a lot of research on the Hu Jintao era and the question of how much think tanks influence, and that was all kind of I build on that. And my kind of motivation was that many people said that but now under Xi it's all different, scholars and think tanks don't play a role at all. That's why you can't look at that. That's not it's all centralized, highly centralized authoritarian rule, societal inference doesn't exist anymore. So I would expect, or I think that they would have exerted more influence. So I think the 2x2 would still work, but one would need to, it would just be like a different, I think the state's openness would be higher. So that would factor into there.
Thanks. Yeah. I'll just open it up to others. Well, you can feel them.
Are you?
Oh, thank you. Thanks for sharing
your So if people can hear you online.
Okay. Thank you so much. I echo Tom's comment about what indicates as influence. When I hear influence, it's really about delta of change. Mm-hmm. So I thought that in your 2x2, if those who are distant from the central authority are being more affected, it seems that's a true influence, whereas people who are close to the state are being, you know, like getting more, their views being more reflected, then it seems more like they're just collaborating with each other. So it was kind of hard for me to kind of conceptualize what influence really is in this context. But I think how you measure and how you define influence actually does work with what you are arguing. I was just curious, based on your finding, what you think, why do you think the Chinese state is even interested in getting views from think tankers and scholars to even define their national interest? Mm-hmm. National interest seems like a pretty solid concept, and with that has a pretty continuity on in their own societal and in government. So if you argue that think tanks are influencing conceptualization of national interest, do you have any theory about why they need those inputs mm-hmm. in constructing national interest?
I think it's because they need to increase their legitimacy. So it's, I think it's definitely, or it's also, the official construction of the national interest also for me captures all these shifts in policy substance, and there I think that is more like issues that can be debated and where the government might also not need input on how they should navigate certain issues or how they should implement this leadership role. So I think that there is where think tanks and scholars influence that's where influencing happens, and in that level the other like for the different components that I distinguish, I think there's not really it's less tangible, it's more like to show there are broad shifts and to give an impression of that, but for actually pinning down influence that doesn't really work. So that's why I looked at for assessing influence, I look more on the policy shifts, and those they can be subtle, but they have to come from somewhere, and I think there the societal actors can play a role.
Yeah. Thank you. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on what possible mechanisms there are for this influence to be transmitted from scholars, think tanks, maybe particularly scholars, to the government. Because, I mean, one possible mechanism, as Professor Christensen said, is that it's actually the influences the other way, or it's they're being fed information. But taking a less cynical view, and perhaps particularly looking at the distant scholars, how do you think this mechanism works, mm-hmm. and how that influence is transmitted?
For the think tanks, there are institutionalized channels through which input or policy recommendations are being fed through the different, mainly through the institutions to which they are affiliated with. So for the Center for International Studies, it's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So those are established channels. Then it's scholars and think tanks know that people in government read their reports and sometimes comment on them, and that's what they get back. So through internal channels this gets fed. And then there are also direct interactions, speeches or lectures for the Politburo, Politburo collective studies sessions, for example. I also suspect that there is more informal policy advising going on.
And you have data for when the scholars actually go to those work study groups for the.
Yeah, for the collective study sessions, that's all public. Yeah, that doesn't happen a lot because. There are, I don't know how often they meet, but they are, of course, on different issues, and foreign policy is only one that appears sometimes. But yeah, I have that, and then I have a lot on more smaller seminars, workshops, things.
And you get data on that, yeah. Who was there and who was not there, yeah. So you can do,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I got that for the scholars. And also for example, something like, recognition from the government, people put that on their CVs. Right?
Yeah, if it's stamped. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a big thing now, especially if you have Xi Jinping stamped.
Yeah, yeah.
But stamped that it was noticed, that it was read and noticed. Yeah. Like, this is a notable thing.
Yeah.
Scholars really looking for that.
Yeah, that's really important for them. Yeah. Yeah, Stephen?
Thanks so much for this project. So I had one question that's more around sort of the general censorship atmosphere or the freedom of expression for scholars and think tanks, kind of getting back to the question around how much they're influencing or they're being influenced by the state. So do you get a sense of how much self-censorship might be going on across some of these topics that you're looking at? Like, are there ever contradictory views? If there are some views expressed, then maybe it suggests that they are more independent thinkers and, you know, views being expressed. Or do you even see examples of like active censorship where publications are made, but then withdrawn or, you know, somehow blocked? Because I guess that would give me a better sense of the extent to which these actors are operating and, you know, expressing views that aren't just being fed from the state. And then the second question I had was kind of around how you define the policy shifts. Is it just a shift among like the relative percentage of these six relatively abstract components, or is it something else within the components, just like getting mm-hmm. a descriptive sense of that? And maybe a question for future work would be, you know, the six components seem not super controversial, maybe now under Xi Jinping. So I was wondering if, you know, thinking about some of the talks we've had recently, if there were contradictory views on Russia or North Korea, which I know gets to like much more tangible policies, but if there were even debates around these, if you could kind of sense a shift that would be like easier to track than some of these abstract components. But just curious kind of how you think about that. Thanks.
Yeah, so on the censorship question, I look at contributions to foreign policy debate that are out there. So I don't know what is, looked at for the think tanks, I looked at policy reports and academic articles published by people working in think tanks. And for scholars, I looked at their academic articles. And I collected all that they published in that time frame, but I would have no idea of knowing what got removed or not. So it's kind of the it's published. It's what is published. And then on the on your forgot the second question.
It was just around like the policy shifts, kind of how they're defined.
Right, So I identified them through frame analysis. So I tried to go through the documents and coded them all. And what I really looked at whether a frame stayed the same or whether they changed, and whether there was a change in kind of substance or in emphasis. So something like we should discuss something, or we should lead the discussion on something. So that would be a shift in degree, and the other one would be a shift in substance. That's how I identify these more subtle shifts. And there's really important to kind of do that over time, because there were these shifts over time, and that so all of this is pretty abstract. And also my I selected the material I selected for that was all on foreign policy in a pretty abstract sense. So I don't look at specific topics or at specific bilateral relationships or something. But that might be something to do in the indeed in the future, to have this argument and see, okay, how does that scholars' influence look on one really narrowly defined foreign policy issue that is kind of prominent right now or so. Lucy?
Stephanie's point on the controversies of the topics, because I noticed that although you used the word debates, but I don't really see that there is an actual debate going on about like whether China should claim for a greater global governance or not. I think that is not a terribly controversial topic in that sense. So maybe it's a matter of when and how, but it's if your case does not capture like the actual formation about how to do it, I think that then I see this like academic network and the government officials kind of go in the same directions. They are not actually influence the government's position that much. The second point I want to ask is that whether you also take into account the geolocation of the universities. I know some universities are more prestigious than the others, depending on where they look at and the ranking of the institutions, and some scholars from those universities are more influential than the others.
Yeah, for that, I try to be as broad as possible to kind of consider different institutions, scholars from different institutions, from different tiers. I mean, there's a very clear, strict hierarchy, and also scholars working on different research issues. Because that might also play a role. So I try to get kind of a broad selection there. And then on the, I mean, you're right. It's not kind of the whole I think they all buy into those broad strokes, and it's more about the how and not so. It's also I think pinning that, as you've seen, pinning down influence is really difficult, and it's also difficult to, or I wouldn't know how to assess if one says that one scholar says we shouldn't engage in global governance at all, and even if that opinion goes is received by the leadership, maybe that changes something in their approach, but it's very difficult to track, right? Because observable outcome would be that China retreats completely from global governance, but that's not a big change. So what I'm looking at, or what I'm focusing, is this really smaller scale change. But I think it's still important, it's what can be observed, and it kind of goes counter that argument that societal actors have no influence at all anymore. So I think,
John.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you, Sabina. That was a great talk. Enjoyed it. I think piggybacking on other people's comments, I still feel like I want to know a little more about how exactly influence is measured. And I think your answer to Stephanie maybe precludes the question, but I was wondering throughout the talk if there was sort of an example of kind of a concrete case where influence takes place, and if you could just kind of illustrate that for us. I mean, my mind goes to like Wang Jisi and the March West concept, Xi Jin, and that the idea that was the intellectual foundations for BRI. I don't know if that's actually like how it played out, maybe not, but that's my understanding. But just maybe talk about kind of a concrete case. Maybe Tom didn't like that example.
He when he wrote that article, he was a fellow, he was a visiting scholar in the China in the World program.
Oh.
So if it's true that if it's true that he invented BRI, then my program is much better planned. I have my doubts, but it's possible. But anyway.
Yeah. I think some concrete examples would be really helpful to kind of ground the discussion. And then two, I was just curious about variation and influence across domains. I mean, I imagine if like kind of one of the key variables here is this idea of the state being more or less closed and open, that obviously I think you talk about how that varies over time with Xi Jinping, but I assume that also varies across domains, economic policy maybe being relatively more open, security policy less open. Maybe thoughts on that. And then I was, I at least was just really struck by the fact that 60% or so of all policy, like discussions related to foreign policy, are on global governance and public goods. Maybe that's totally common sense, but I thought that was kind of interesting. And thoughts on why that's the case. Maybe that's just because global governance is like such a broad topic, as we've talked about, that it's kind of like an umbrella for a lot of different things. So if that's the case, then within the global governance umbrella, what are the specific things that are being talked about? I'd be interested to know.
So on that thing about the different domains, that's exactly what I need to test. I think it's very common to assume that for economic policy there is a lot. It's more open. I need to test that. I need to figure that out. And then the other comment. So one of my kind of motivations was that these so the example you cited, and there are a couple of others, those are the ones that always come up in the literature, and that there are some concepts that are very close linked to certain individuals. And what I tried to do was to kind of do a more systematic account, and also focus more like on the structure, on the changes in domestic structures and how that conditions influence and to kind of get at that. But in presenting that evidence, it's a bit challenging to present that evidence, because ultimately what you want to know is what policy shift was influenced and who did what. So it does come back to people, and I'm now thinking about ways on how I can kind of combine these two approaches without throwing out what I did and going back to what all other people did, but kind of take the argument on the structures, but also kind of fill that up with more of a story. And
please. Sorry.
Thank you. I was wondering if your sample also has researchers or academics who have expertise, like regional expertise, as opposed to IR expertise or disciplinary expertise, linguistic expertise, some people who are less replaceable. Mm-hmm. So how would influence work there?
I looked at international studies, international relations departments across China. I used university rankings from different sources to identify the most, 21 most important ones. But I looked at how the university defines IR, sometimes that does include people working more on different regions. But I didn't do so. I had to narrow that down.
So one of the most convincing part of your talks was the idea that what the think tanks and scholars are saying is not the same thing as what the leaders are saying. So you kind of knock down they're just parroting what they're being fed by the government. But it was only later in your talk that you talked about the time factor, they were saying different things before the government adopted a new approach to some problem. But it's not, these are very abstract things. This is national interest, not specific policies, right? So that part, I think, in terms of presentation, I would encourage you to move it up, because mm-hmm. I saw a lot of graphs about the gap mm-hmm. before I saw influence.
Mm-hmm.
So you spent about, I would say, 15 to 20 minutes knocking down this idea that what think tankers are saying is just repeating what they read in the People's Daily.
Mm-hmm.
And you did that very convincingly, but it didn't get at what your main mm-hmm. your main talking points were, your main thesis is. Recently, and this maybe is more policy than it is national interest, because you're really interested in the definition of the national interest, which again is a very abstract and broad notion. It almost certainly influences policy, but you don't explore that. But you get asked about it all the time, you said, right? What's the connection to actual policies?
Yeah.
I noticed that after the San Francisco summit between Xi Jinping and Joseph Biden, someone did an analysis. I'll get you the site and give it to you. Someone did an analysis of what all the scholars and think tanks were saying about the summit. And they were all saying the same thing. So it seemed like they were copying what they were told. That's still useful data for us students of China's foreign relations, because if they're being told that, that's the message the government wants to get out. So, and it's a strong message if it's pure across all these different organizations. So it's useful information, but you didn't get a sense from those reactions that the individual scholars were influencing the policy world. It seemed like they were parroting, but maybe that's more specific than formation of the national interests. I'm not sure how you would react to that, but there is an article just came out like 3 days ago.
So it was after the summit, right? I mean, there's
after the summit. What are the thinking heads in China saying about the summit? And they all seem to be saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Even the most skeptical, pessimistic analysts of the past, like Wu Xinbo at Fudan University, was saying, oh, it was a great success, historic, wonderful, you know, everything was great. What a great leader we have. He really did great. And the only differences are really the degree of remaining skepticism, like we'll have to see. We'll have to see whether this really produces results or whether it, you know, it doesn't last. So I don't know how you would react to that, but I think it's useful to engage with these people no matter what your belief system is about it. If they're feeding you government lines, you're learning government lines. If they are reporting rather than advising, then in a track two, if you get a message to them, they will pass it to people who maybe have more influence. Mm-hmm. Or if they have influence, then you're affecting their view and it may affect their advice. So it's all good no matter what to engage with them, but how it matters is what you're trying to get at.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks. Do we have other questions? Yes, sir. Yeah.
In terms of gathering data, what are the sources? So before COVID, I had a friend from Shandong. You know, I started his research in 1993 when I went to Hong Kong on a Fulbright with the, so I reported to the U.S. Information Service. I'm not formally in a think tank, but I do provide some ideas. So what happened was that I got this a WeChat, a link from a friend from Shandong. And that opened up a connection to Toto. I don't know if you, any of you use Toto. Okay. How do you get in there? Well, it sort of has to be part of the network. So I spent 2 years during COVID. Every morning, every day, I open up Toto. And the conversation is fascinating. All kind of topic. It really focused on the idea that Xi Jinping wanted to go back to China, the emperor, the imperial bureaucracy system. And then...
Who were the members of Kyoto?
No.
Just people, regular people? People.
Fascinating.
They're not government think tanks.
No, no.
They're just people.
They unleash an entourage of ethnographer with the iPhone, with their Huawei phone. I spent 10 months getting a major grant from the state to be in Hong Kong. They do the same thing, in the cheap. So all the stuff about a culture, particularly Hakka culture, every day I hear this chat. It's fascinating. It interweaves Chinese mythology, the origin of Chinese civilization from Yan Wang, right? This all this stuff. I said, wait a minute. I thought this is so that. Chinese culture, that is what Xi is promoting, to a point where there was a conference just in November in Jiangxi about the Hakka culture, in which everyone went to a temple to provide honor to the ancestor, the revival of ancestral, whether you call worship, connection. Now, the interesting thing is that all kind of stuff, revival. So in Guangzhou, I went there in May, being a consultant to the LA Guangzhou sister city connection. I visited a museum, the Five Museum, on a figure named Zhao Tuo. In one of the museum, you have the figure of Fu Xi and Nui Hua. These are the mythical figure that's the equivalent of Adam and Eve. And they're right in the front of the. So my point is this. There are a lot of stuff in terms of gathering data, really big data, through WeChat.
Yeah, you can do large.
Through Toto, through TikTok.
But I just want to ask you a question in line with Sabina's thesis. Is your impression that these discussions of traditional Chinese culture are being fed from the top, that Xi Jinping wants to link to Chinese traditional culture?
It's interactive.
Or do you think the public is sending messages up to the top saying we ought to link to?
It's a interactive.
So it's hard to say.
They are so nimble. The research, whoever's behind this, is so astute to gather the thoughts of the on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's very interactive because the responses, whether you're for this or criticize this, it's not a name. It's a icon that you use, right?
Yeah.
So if you scroll down to the end, you get all kind of opposition.
Yeah.
So what the researcher does is they pick this up.
Yeah. Right?
And they modify the policy.
Right.
Well, I noticed a major shift in the identity called Hakka identity.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting. The last English book that was written about Hakka identity was 2013 by the German university, Bureau. And if you follow that identity, they are promoting it from the China point of view. That's why this year was here, was in Jiangxi. next year is in Luoyang, mm-hmm. which is north. Oh, yeah. The following year is in Hainan Island. Mm-hmm. There's a strategy all the way back to 2023 mm-hmm. about this educational, cultural. That's my.
And you think it's
that's
essential.
Sort of my.
You think it's essential strategy?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
It's the playbook. It's just so consistent. So if you have a conference that connects in the center of the story, you get a brand new city. Mm-hmm. They'll build a city for you mm-hmm. to promote that. They're going to do that in Luoyang. They did that in Jiangxi. They're going to do that in Hainan. Mm-hmm. Not Nanhai, Hainan, the island.
Yeah.
Because the. So it's a very important, it's amazing. I'm just amazed at the people behind it, you know.
Yeah. What you
no
just
name, no name, yeah. right? No name. Individual who are right. on the ground, people in the villages taking video, and this whole it's all in the right. data.
What you describe is also part of what people write about digital authoritarianism.
Oh, yeah.
So that they have an ability to do big data research in real time on whatever's happening on these networks. And that's why certain terms and arguments disappear.
But the thing is that people are not only dumb.
Right. So they try to avoid it.
They take it with a grain of salt. It's a very fascinating interaction.
But things disappear online, and that is a source of study in and of itself. What disappears?
Okay. So, for example,
yeah.
4 years, 5, 6 years ago, Beijing produced a documentary mm-hmm. about Hakka. Right. You could even get in YouTube. Mm-hmm. It disappeared. Why? Because a certain aspect was proven to be debunked. Mm-hmm. So go back to the issue about using Stalin. What they did is that they quoted Stalin in this documentary about an hour about particular identity. They quoted professors from university in the north. But some of these professors, the data is
weak. Yeah.
Now you cannot find it in YouTube.
Yeah. But sometimes it's just controversy. So one of the things, you know, I don't know what your reaction to this is, but we should probably eat. But you know, it was stunning to me after the Russian invasion of Ukraine that in track twos in publications, you couldn't get any Chinese scholar to say that Russia invaded Ukraine. They would say there was a conflict. There's a conflict. There were tensions that escalated. But there was never the word invasion wasn't used. Mm-hmm. And now what's difficult to find, you can find it, but it's difficult to find, is any reference to Hamas. You could talk about mm-hmm. Palestinian-Israeli differences and problems. You can't talk about Hamas because Hamas, yeah. you know, that would hurt the narrative mm-hmm. from the
Chinese.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that there are people on WeChat putting Hamas into their messages and those are disappearing.
Yeah,
right. That's just how the system works. Yeah. So there are people who study that because they see things pop up for a split second, and you're able to capture it in real time.
Yeah,
but the last thing is, this is in terms of digital authoritarianism, is the Chinese state does pay attention to public opinion, and you address public opinion, pays very careful attention to it. And one of the ways it does it is by monitoring these social networks and seeing who's upset and why.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how they react to that is another matter. They may crack someone's head who complains, or they may complain against a local official, but they're clearly watching.
Yeah.
And they have the artificial intelligence tools to do it. So you don't have to have too many people. You just have to have some algorithms, right? Anyway, thanks very much for your presentation, Sabina, and welcome to your family. And we get to feed your family as well as invite them.
No, so, I need to bring it. Get to bed.
Yeah, thanks so much, and please join me and